Hope, like I said, hope everybody had a nice Pesach under the circumstances, and it's gets back to, you know, to learning as much as we can. And Boker Tov, and welcome to our post Pesach, you know, online learning. Okay, so we figure, since, as you all know, there's a minhag to learn Pirkei Avot on Shabbos in the summer months. The original minhag, of course, began on between Pesach and Shavuot, and being that there are 6 weeks between Pesach and Shavuot, but of course there are only 5 chapters in Pirkei Avot. I'm sure many of you know that the 6th chapter of Pirkei Avot is not actually part of Pirkei Avot, not part of the Mishnah. And there's a little line that says, you know, Shanu Chachamim Bilshon HaMishnah. Our rabbis taught in the language of the Mishnah. It's sort of it's parallel to the Mishnah. That was added in for the 6th week, the week before the holiday of Shavuot, which of course in rabbinic literature is all about receiving of the Torah. And therefore the 6th chapter talks about Torah. It's all about the importance of Torah, the importance of learning Torah. That's where you have the 48 ways, how we are konator, how we acquire Torah. The minhag to study it in the summer is probably related to the fact that our moral compass is a little bit down. It tends to be a little bit down in the summer. The weather's nicer, people are up and around, the people aren't in school anymore. There probably is a connection to that. Pirkei Avot, of course, is different of the 63 Masechtot in the Talmud. So this is really the only one that has a non-legal focus. The other 62 Masechtot of the Talmud, of course, deal with legal issues, divided into the 6 orders of the Mishnah, Zraim, Moed, Nashim, Nezikim, Kochim, and Tarot, laws of agriculture, laws of the holidays, family life, business dealings, the temple, laws of purity. And very interestingly, Pirkei Avot is situated in Seder Nezikim, which deals with the interactions between human beings. Nezikim is the torts and contract laws, and you know, in the court system, all the relationship between man and man. And it's there that we put Pirkei Avot, because that's, of course, it deals with relationships between people, and that's, of course, where ethics are most needed. You don't need ethics on Yom Kippur so much. Nobody comes to shul on Yom Kippur and talks about what dishonest business deal they can enter, or how to cheat somebody, or how they're ripping off people in their business. That they do, in different circumstances. Yom Kippur, we don't have to worry about it, but we have to worry about it when we're dealing with the issues of interaction between human beings. So it is quite fascinating that Masechet Avot was placed in Seder Nezikin. And I will point out something very interesting. Different rabbis have different specialties, just like, you know, medical doctors. It's impossible, even in the time of the Talmud, it's impossible for any one person to know everything. And there were experts. We know, for example, when there are debates between Rav and Shmuel. So we say that when it comes to monetary matters, we follow Rav. When it comes to religious matters, follow Shmuel. We have different rules who we follow, because different people were different experts. So we had experts in Agadata. We had experts in the non-legal portions of the Talmud. And they're actually, I counted here, I have the Mishnah Seturah, if people can see. It is a great, I love this edition of the Mishnah. It's very clear without really any commentaries, but just puts it in the structure, how you read it, highlights all the names. So they have in the back an index of all the rabbis who appear in the Mishnah, and wherever they appear. So you want to look up all the hundreds of times the Rabbi Akiva is in the Mishnah, you can look it up. So I went through this in Pirkei Avot, and it turns out there are 22 rabbis who appear only once, and only in Pirkei Avot. That the 22 of the spaces include people like Ben Hehei and Ben Bagbag, Elisha Ben Avuya. We'll see in a moment, the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. The only time the Anshei Knesset Hagdola is ever mentioned is in Pirkei Avot. So that's in itself, I thought that was a fascinating sort of idea, that these were rabbis who specialized in, you want to call it ethical teachings, you want to call it the morals, human relations, but that's, many of the rabbis we only encounter in Pirkei Avot. Some of them are famous because Pirkei Avot is very lovely and beautiful, and people study it more often. So people know these rabbis a little bit more, but some of them are really appear nowhere else in the entire Talmud. Okay, that's by way of a very general introduction. Then let me just give a second piece of introduction. By the way, if people have a Pirkei Avot in front of them, that would be excellent. I can even take a 15-second break if you can get it. It wouldn't hurt. But Pirkei Avot, okay, I said I'll take a 15-second break. Okay, so I will. It's in every Seder after Mincha for Shabbos, and that's the easiest place to find it. Okay, so Pirkei Avot lists off in the first chapter the passing down of our tradition. We know the first Mishnah begins that Moshe kibbutz Torah miSinai, Masara liYoshua, that Moshe got the Torah at Sinai, gave it to Yoshua. We'll come back to this. Went to the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, and then the Mishnah continues listing off the historical passing down of our tradition. So we know that after the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, we have what's known as the five Zugot, the five pairs of rabbis who led the Jewish people. The last of those five Zugot pairs are Hillel and Shammai, but their teachers are Shmaya and Avtalion. So those five leaders, one was the Nasi, the political head, so to speak, of the Jewish people, and one was the Abbeitin, the head of our Sanhedrin. So you go from Moshe, the Nevi'im, the Zkenim, the Nevi'im, Anshei Knesset Gdola, the five Zugot, and then you get to the period of the Tanaim, the authors of the Mishnah. And we know that the Mishnah, maybe a lot of people are not aware of this, the Mishnah basically takes place over six generations. And the head of the Nasi for each of those six generations really was an inherited position. So you have, let's say, Hillel. Hillel's the transition generation to the period of the Mishnah. Hillel dies about, it says in the Talmud he died 100 years before the destruction of the temple. I don't know if that means it in a literal sense. The Talmud there has a lot of sort of historical data it puts in, but Hillel died, 75, 100 years before the destruction of the temple. Then we enter the period of the Tanaim. So either his son or grandson is Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Rabban Gamliel the Elder. Then his son, Rab Shimon ben Gamliel, who is killed by the Romans at the time of the destruction of the temple. And then the next Nasi is Rabban Gamliel the Yavna, the famous Rabban Gamliel who we met at the Seder, who the fights with Rabbi Yoshua. So that Rabban Gamliel, the Yavna, and generally, whenever the Mishnah quotes Rabban Gamliel, it's the second Rabban Gamliel. The Mishnah will say Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, the elder Rabban Gamliel. And he too had a son, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. So you have Hillel, Rabban Gamliel, HaZaken, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel the Yavne, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel HaSheni, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi dies around the year 220. And of course, he's the final editor of the Mishnah. He's not the editor of the Mishnah. The Mishnah took 50, 60 years to edit already in the time of Rabbi Akiva, who's killed around 135 in the Bar Kokhba revolt. Mishnah, the process of editing the Mishnah is beginning. And Rabbi Yehuda of collating all the oral law. The rabbis knew already with the destruction of the temple that eventually they're going to have to write down the oral law. It was initially only allowed to be in oral tradition. That's another discussion. And it got, it was ended at Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi around the year 220. And the first chapter of the Mishnah basically brings the transmission of Torah with eight teaching, one or two teaching from each of these people. Like, you know, you pretty much did Anshei Knesset Gdola, the Zugot, the five pairs of Zugot, then the Tanaim. Now it's fascinating. Okay, if you look the last two Mishnayot in the first parak, you have after Shammai, you have Hillel and Shammai, then you have Rabban Gamliel. Aselech HaRav, make a rabbi, Stalik mean Hasapek, then you have his son, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, Shimon beno, and then you skip to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel of Yavne is not mentioned in the Mishnah. I think that's a fascinating omission. You go through every single one of the Nesim is mentioned, Rabban Willi is skipped over, probably related to the fact when he was impeached, when he insulted Rabbi Yoshua too many times, and they impeached him. And for whatever reason, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, here when he edited the Mishnah, passes over Rabban Gamliel. The truth of the matter is we have that at the Seder. The five rabbis in Bnei Brak who are up all night discussing this, the Seder, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, so noticeably missing is Rabban Gamliel. And in the Tosefta, which is sort of a parallel Tanaitic period, it's from the same period of the Mishnah, but was not included in the Mishnah. In the Tosefta, there is a parallel story where Rabban Gamliel was studying not so much the story. We have in our Haggadah the story of Egypt, that he was learning the laws of Pesach all night. So that's sort of we'll see that sort of this ambivalence towards Rabban Gamliel. But the first chapter is basically a recording of our Masorah. And the second chapter begins with Rabbi Omer, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who's rarely quoted in the Mishnah, is the editor of the Mishnah. In other words, he's really collecting all the data in a sense before him. But we quote Rabbi and then we quote his son, Rabban Gamliel, Beno, Shel Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So we're already, this was clearly added in, or maybe not, maybe Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was quoting his own son, or was added in later. And then we go back to Hillel. So the Mishnah sort of lists off in historical order. And then in the middle of the second chapter, in Mishnah Dalit, we move to Hillel, and then we go to a sort of a second line of the passing of our tradition. And that's Hillel's, not top student, but Hillel's, I don't know how to put this. The Talmud says that the weakest, I use that term in quotation marks, the weakest student of Hillel was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. That the Talmud says Rav Hillel had 120 students. It's also, I'm sure, not a exact historical number. Had 120 students. The top student was Yonatan ben Uziel, and the quote unquote the lesser student. I don't know what word to use. It's hard to say that with Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, which basically what the Talmud is saying is we know that intellectual ability or knowledge is not the number one criteria for leadership. Leadership requires, you know, so much more. We know that it's not the A+ student who necessarily does the best. It's someone who combines other talents. But anyways, we follow that tradition, Hillel, and the one who really picked up on Hillel is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the one who saved Judaism at the destruction of the temple. And then we go to his students. Remember in the second chapter, it says there were five famous students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, and the Rabbi Yoshua. And then the Mishnah, the second chapter, lists off three teaching of each of these rabbis. So basically, the first two chapters of Berkei Avot is a historical development of the Torah from a little bit Moshe, being beginning at Moshe, all the way through the son of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah, skipping over Rabban Gamliel, and then we have sort of a second stream. That's which this is the stream of greater leadership. In other words, the
Are
center.
You gonna rip the laundry basket off, fold it.
I'm sorry. Okay, no, I'm gonna. Everybody should be muted, please, unless you have to. You want to interrupt with a question. Anyways, then you have the second stream, which is the ones who actually were the main teachers of Torah. In other words, the Nasi, clearly Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's son, is not famous. He's not one of the great Tanaim, not one of the great teachers in the Mishnah, where, of course, the students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai are really the leaders and the ones who preserved Judaism in a very difficult time. Okay, that's just a few words of introduction. Now let's go back to the beginning. Berkei Avot, the first few Mishnot are very famous. Hopefully we can add a little bit of insight and some ideas. Feel free to make any comments or questions if you have. Moshe kiva Torah Mishinai Masar Yeshua. Moshe got the Torah Mishinai. So I just noticed, I had never noticed this. It's why always when you teach, is that you have to thank your students. A comment of the Bartanura. Rav Avadja mi Bartanura is the most important commentary on the Mishnah, living around, I believe, the 15th century. The Mishnah was, throughout most of Jewish history, the Mishnah was never studied as an independent text. The Mishnah was always studied in conjunction with the Talmud. The Bartanura is really the first, outside of the Rambam, The Bartanura is the first major commentary on the Mishnah itself, divorced from the Gemara. In other words, where you can study Mishnah as an independent work. Anyway, So the Bartanura points out that Mi-Sinai, when he said that Moshe got the Torah at Sinai, so what does that mean? He got the, so all he writes is Mi-Mishanik le-Mi-Sinai. He got the Torah from the one who appeared, who revealed himself at Sinai. The Bartanura is very, very subtly making a very important point that Moshe, of course, did not receive the entire Torah at Sinai. Some people sort of have that impression that God gave the entire Torah to, at Har Sinai. It's obviously, it can't be true, because we know much of the Torah, many of the laws of the Torah were in response to events that happened in the desert, happened later in Har Sinai. So it's not that Moshe received the entire Torah at Sinai, but Moshe got parts of the Torah at Sinai. There's a debate in the Talmud when he wrote it down. Was it written down at the time? Would he written down chapter by chapter only at the end? But anyways, Moshe got the Torah at Sinai, gave it to Yoshua. Yoshua gave it to the elders. The Skenim gave it to the Levim as Rul Anshei Knesset Agdola. And the Levim gave it to the Anshei Knesset Agdola. Now, you notice the Mishnah does, and then Heimam Ru Shlosha Dvarim. The Anshei Knesset Agdola had three teachings, three famous like teachings. Why don't we mention any teaching of Moshe, Yoshua, the Skenim, or the Levim? How can we not mention any of their teachings? So I think the answer is relatively obvious. Those teachings are in Tanakh. The teachings of Moshe and Yoshua and the Skenim and the Nevi'im, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, etc., that you open up a Tanakh. The Anshei Knesset Agdola is the beginning of the Second Temple period. This is a major transition point, of course, in Jewish history, both destructions of the Temple, the Babylonian exile in 586, we come back to Israel. Ezra is sort of the main leader of the Jewish people back to Israel. According to many sources, he's the founder of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. I mentioned last week, 120 people in the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. That's why the Israeli Knesset of today has 120 members. They wanted to model themselves after the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. So Torah underwent a radical change. It's really the oral law only really begins to develop at this point. Prior to the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, prior to the the return of Jewish people to Israel, the Torah was a written Torah. If you had a question, you could go to the high priest in the temple. He could read in his Urim v'Tumim. He could communicate with God. We had prophets to tell us what to do. We didn't have to do very much. We just had to listen. I mean, it was hard, but we just had to listen to the prophets. We didn't have to figure out what the Torah is saying. And most of Jewish law was not developed yet at this point. Jewish law was basically based on the Torah. So much of Talmudic law, many of them are developed later. I know this is sort of often a difficult concept for people, and I don't want to get too much into it now. It's an important subject, but many of the Torah laws, like even, let's say, the 39 Melachot of Shabbat, it's pretty clear they didn't exist during the time of Tanakh. They didn't have all of them. When the rabbis analyze a verse in the Torah, you know, the Yud Gimel Midot, the 13 rules of how to analyze a verse in Torah, rabbis introduce biblical law. In other words, a biblical and rabbinic law is not a historical idea that the laws given, you know, at up to a certain point, and the laws in the Bible are biblical. After the Bible, it's rabbinic. It's not true at all. The Talmud tells us that Moshe made rabbinic laws. The notion of having a week of celebration after a wedding, Sheva Brachot, the Gemara, I believe, says that was a rabbinic law by Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe was a rabbi, so Moshe introduced rabbinic laws. And I would say the vast majority of biblical law was actually not developed in the time of the Bible. God gave the Torah to us, Torah lo b'shamayim. The Torah is not in heaven, and the rabbis in each generation, especially when we had a Sanhedrin, the rabbis in each generation would analyze the words of the Torah and would deduce from their reading between the lines of the Torah new laws, and those laws are of biblical origin. They give a very simple example from nowadays. You know, so people will say, well, how can driving a car, we assume driving a car is a biblical prohibition. That's our assumption. So some may disagree, but anyway, so how can that be a biblical prohibition? It didn't exist in the time of the Bible. There were no cars. The answer is obvious. We just take the principles of the Torah and apply them to a new situation. But on a more fundamental level, a lot of the Torah that we know was really developed beginning with the Anshei Knesset HaGdola through the Second Temple period and in the time of the Mishnah. And that's, of course, the famous debate that got Rabban Gamliel, with Rav Elezer and Rav Yeshua, you know, Torah lo b'shamayim. Man has the right and the obligation to interpret the Torah, even if God, so to speak, disagrees. In the first time period of Jewish history, when we had prophets, God told us what to do. God revealed his will through Moshe and Yeshua and Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu and Amos and Micha and Yonah. God revealed his will through the prophets. But when the period of prophecy ended, Esther is considered to be the last of the prophets. Esther period, Purim marks the end of the period of prophecy. We are into a new period, and God doesn't tell us what to do. We have to figure it out. And the rabbis say the last pasuk in Megillat Esther, that Mordechai was beloved, l'rov echav, to the majority of the Jewish people, 55%. And the Mishnah, I don't know if it's 55%, but it might have been. People always complain about their leaders. The Gemara says, Rav Echav, that not all of them, members of the Sanhedrin, were very upset at Mordechai. They didn't like his policy. Why did he risk the Jewish people by not bowing to Haman? They had all kinds of complaints about Mordechai. At this period, we don't have clarity anymore. It's sort of what we call Hester Panim. God, Hester Panim, we often use in a philosophical term, but it's also halachically that it's up to us. And the Talmud says, Achacham Adif Minapi, that the sages are greater than the prophets. It's much better that we figure it out on our own, even though we don't always know if we're doing right. But we say, Elu ve'elu divir Elohim Chayim. Two great sages can interpret the Torah in different ways, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. That's where it's said by. And even though they say opposite things, they're both correct in theory. They're both the manifestation of Torah. Torah can be interpreted in many ways. And however the rabbis decide to interpret the Torah, that's the way it's done in practice. So this whole process of sort of the change of the nature of Torah from a God-given instructions, what to do, to man figuring out, our great sages figuring out what to do, begins with the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. The reason this is strange for so many of us, I think, maybe I'm wrong, is because in a certain sense it stopped with the destruction, with the writing of the Mishnah, the writing of the Gemara, when our Sanhedrin, we no longer had a Sanhedrin, we no longer really have the power to interpret the Torah and make up new biblical laws. But when we will have a Sanhedrin, we will have that ability. And that's this is pretty standard stuff. So we're frozen in time a little bit. And as a matter of fact, that's why some of the commentaries explain why the law had to be oral, why we were opposed to writing the Torah, because a written Torah, anything written is fixed. It's, you know, it's etched in stone. Oral is flexible, and it, and the Dor Revi, the great grandson of the Chatam Sofer, who has a beautiful introduction to his development of Torah Sheba'al Peh. So this is made, one of his major points is that God wanted the Torah to be oral, so it didn't we didn't restrict future generations. That every generation didn't have to rely on precedent and do what other people said. We want the Torah to be flexible. Unfortunately, we lost that ability. It's very hard to do that when Jews are all over the world. He was the Dor Revi of Moshe Shmuel Glasner, like I said, the eldest great grandson of the Chatam Sofer. That's why he comes up Dor Revi. He was basically thrown out of Hungary. He was a Hungarian Zionist rabbi. That's like almost an oxymoron. If you know the history of Hungarian Jewry, they're the most, Satmar comes from Hungary. They're the most anti-Zionist, and he was a big Zionist. And he moved to Israel in 1921, and part of his, he died, I believe, in 1924. And one of his whole ideas is, now that we're returning to the land of Israel, we'll soon establish a Sanhedrin, and we're going to go back to the original law as an oral law that develops organically in every generation. Anyways, that's a little bit sort of the major change. So the Mishnah doesn't mention anything. Moshe, Yeshua's gaining, that's all in the Torah Bechtav. That's all the written law. Now we're developing, we're entering the Torah. I mean, we're reading it as it's written down, but we're entering into the stage where the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, becomes the major focus of Jewish life. Then we're period of with the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And by the way, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the rabbis say they're called Anshei Knesset HaGdola because they return Judaism to its former glory. We say it's in Parshat Ekev, Ha'el HaGadol HaGibor, where we say in the Shmon Esrei, And the Gemara says the Jewish people, they stopped saying it. How can you say God is all awesome and powerful? The Jewish people are suffering. We're in exile. And the Anshei Knesset goal is sort of restore Torah to its glory. And they were the ones who established our Shmon Esrei. The Amidah, that we said, say 18 brachot. We spoke last week on the adding of the ninth. So the 18 brachot of Shmon Esrei were already established by the Anshei Knesset goal. We're going back 2,500 years already. They were the ones who established the notion that we make Kiddush on Friday night, Havdalah on Saturday night, and our brachot. The fact that a Jew makes a blessing when he eats an apple, that comes from the Anshei Knesset Havdalah. They set the patterns of Jewish life that we still observe 2,500 years later. The rituals of Jewish life was established by the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. Okay. Now, the Anshei Knesset Hagdola said three things. Obviously, they said many more, but the mission is picking out three things they like to do. So let's just quickly go over them. Or have a matunim betin. Be matun in din. Be deliberate, I think, is how they translate. I don't have an English translation in front of me, but I think that's how most of them translated. In other words, a dayan, a judge, has to take his time to say something. I remember Rav Schechter like telling us when I was in Hishir, Rav Hershel Schechter from Yeshiva University, telling us that, Rav Soloveitchik would complain often that America, he said in Europe, Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski, the great posek in pre-war, lived in Vilna, died in 1941, not because of the Nazis, died of natural causes. Soon after the Nazis came into Vilna, but Yimach Shemam. But Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski was a relative of the Soloveitchiks, so he was the greatest posek. He would get a complicated question, the Rav Soloveitchik would say it would take him 2-3 weeks to answer. He would consult with other rabbis. He would, study, look over everything, and he wouldn't, it would take him a few weeks. Today in America, he says that the somebody calls up the rabbi. Questions are much more complicated in America. Life is much more complicated and very difficult questions dealing with, marriage issues, mamzeris and gittin, very complicated issues we have in America, of course. Life is more complicated. And they would expect the rabbi to give an answer on the phone. And if the rabbi says yes, look it up, like the old joke. Well, what are we paying the rabbi for? We thought you're finished your learning. So that there's a lot of a truth to that, this whole internet, answering questions on the internet. I'm not a big fan of that because halacha is at least as subjective as objective. There's an objective part to halacha, but halacha also is a very subjective aspect to it. It's an art and a science. And while the science you can answer online, the art you can't. The art, you have to know the person. And that's why a Selech HaRav, which we'll have twice in the first chapter in Pirkei Avot, you have to have a rabbi who knows you, who understands where you're coming from. And it's well known that two people can ask the exact same question and properly get two different answers. So, this idea that everything quickly, we live in a generation, that's so the first thing the Anshei Knesset Hagdola says, the rabbis have to take their time, answer slowly, look at nuance. Two questions that look alike may have a nuance that they're not quite the same. So it's a very important idea, one that's, I think, especially important in our generation, and people have to understand. Things take time. You can't expect an answer right away. Number two, Hamidu Talmidim Harpe, have a lot of students. So this seems like a no-brainer, obviously. We're going to have Jewish education should be for everybody. It's supposed to be free, but okay, that's a whole different discussion. Yeshua Ben Gamla, Institute of Free Education, but okay. But the truth of the matter, it's not so simple. This gets us back to our debate between Rabban Gamliel that we mentioned earlier. When Rabban Gamliel was impeached and they appointed Rabbi Elazar Ben Azari, he was the compromised candidate. They didn't want to appoint Rabbi Yeshua. That would be a slap in the face. Rabban Gamliel three times had publicly embarrassed Rabbi Yeshua. And when in the middle of his shir, he's giving a shir, and the third time he embarrasses Rabbi Yeshua, and the people listening said, enough already, stop. And in the middle of the shir, they ordered him stop. They impeached him, and then they had to look for a new candidate. They said, we don't want Rabbi Yeshua. That's a slap in the face. That's not so nice. Rabbi Akiva, now, he doesn't have any yichis. He came 40. He was a shepherd. No one's going to respect him. So they went to this unknown, young, 18-year-old, candidate who didn't have any enemies yet. He was new in the world. So Rav Elazar ben Azaria, the famous story, he said, let me ask my wife. He asked his wife. His wife said, what, are you crazy? What, in this job? They'll fire you. They fired him. They'll fire you. Who wants to be working in the Jewish community? You're fired. Well, who needs the headaches? So he said, even for one day, to work, to have the merit to serve the Jewish people is such an honor. And his wife said in the famous story that his hair grew white overnight. That's not a miracle. You work for the Jewish community, your hair grows white overnight. And Harani Kiven Shivim Shana, that's what he said at the Seder. He's like 70. So that's a well-known story. It's also, I think, and then they say, so Rav Elazar ben Azaria, he's the new leader. He's the new Nasi. They've impeached Rabban Gamliel. So he had a new agenda. Every new leader brings in his own policies. So his policy was, the first policy the Mishnah said, the Gemara in Brachot said that he did, was he got rid of the doorman. There was a security guard at the Beit Midrash. Rabban Gamliel felt that only the elite of the elite should learn. If you want to create great Torah scholars, you can't let in everybody. So, and he was concerned that, and also the moral character. You had to have what they called, the expression of Tocho Kiboro. Your inside and your outside were the same. And Rabban Gamliel had a very strict, restrictive policy. And the Talmud says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria threw the guard away, and he put up signs, everybody's welcome in the Beit Midrash. And that day, I think the Talmud has two opinions, either 400 or 700 benches had to be brought in. And, there were so many people who Rabban Gamliel had kept out of the Beit Midrash. And the Gemara says Rabban Gamliel nearly had a heart attack. He said, when he saw what happened, he said, oh my God, 700 people or benches coming in. What did I prevent? And then he saw in a dream that these are not real students. They're just they're warming the benches. They're not really learning. And the Torah says that really wasn't true. They weren't warming the benches. They were learning, but they didn't want to make Rabban Gamliel feel so bad. It's a beautiful story. They make up. Rabbi Yeshua and Rabban Gamliel make up. And the Gemara says Rabban Gamliel was extremely wealthy. Rabbi Yeshua went to visit him. Rabban Gamliel went to his house to ask forgiveness. And he walked into his house and he said, "I see you're a blacksmith," because he saw the on the walls, all the mark on the wall. I see you're a blacksmith. And Rabbi Yeshua comment, "Oi, how terrible! Woe unto the generation where the leaders don't know how the average person lives." It's also fascinating, very important comment, when the leaders are detached from the people, which I think we all know is a very common problem we have today in the democratic world, and of course, obviously in the non-democratic world, but even in our democratic world. Anyways, they made up. So you had a debate whether you should open up the Beit Midrash to everybody. So when the Chachamim, the Anshei Knesset Agdola says, Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbei, that's not Rabban Gamliel's view. That's the view of Rav Elazar ben Azaria. Rav Soloveitchik had a beautiful insight on this story, always has beautiful insights. The conclusion of the story is, after Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua made up, so they reappointed Rabban Gamliel. New majority has Rav Elazar ben Azaria, so they would take turns. So Rabban Gamliel, and how do you know who the rabbi is who gives the speech on Shabbos morning? Who gave the drush on Shabbos? The Gemara said, Shabbat Shalmi Haya. Whose Shabbos was this week? Two out of the 3 weeks Rabban Gamliel spoke, and one of the 3 weeks Rav Elazar ben Azaria spoke. So they split in this the leadership of the Jewish people. And Rav Soloveitchik points out what the Gemara is really teaching us is that both approaches are needed. You need an approach of an elite institution. Harvard University doesn't accept everybody, because it wouldn't be Harvard. Harvard and Yale and Stanford, you have to be great. Oxford, Cambridge, the reason they're who they are is they only take the A plus students. You want to develop greatness, you can't develop greatness when you open it up to everybody. Everybody has a right to learn Torah, but very few people are going to become great scholars. And therefore, the Talmud is playing out on the tension between these. On the one hand, everybody can learn. On the one hand, you need to have elite institutions. And that's Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria's approach. And what we're sort of saying is, yes, you want to develop first open to everybody. And then those who are the best, you separate them and you have them learn. So that's when they say Hamidu Talmidim Harbei, that's really the view only of Rav Elazar ben Azaria, not the view of Rabban Gamliel. I think it was Rav Soloveitchik also pointed out Hamidu Talmidim Harbei. It's a funny word. It should say teach students. What do you mean, hamidu? Stand up many students. And of course, the role of a teacher is to have a student stand up on its own, not to be dependent on the teacher. Rav Soloveitchik was very much like this. People would ask him questions. He would tell them, you answer the question. Sometimes Rav Soloveitchik said, okay, I'll give you some source material you may not be aware of. I'll tell you a few ideas. They asked you, you're the rabbi, you know the congregant, you answer the question. Don't rely on rabbis. And it's so different from how so much of Jewish life is nowadays. But hamidu talmidim arbei. Obviously, we're expect the student has to know their limits. They have to know when they can't answer questions. But to turn to rabbis who don't know the people, or even if they do know the people, that's not their job. Your job is to answer the question. So hamidu talmidim arbei. Allow your students to stand on your own. Basis yak l'Torah, and make a fence around the Torah. This, of course, is a notion of rabbinic law that I would say. I mean, most of what we do, at least in the realm between man and God, in the realm between man and man, most of the mitzvot are biblical. Not to gossip, to be honest in business, not to take revenge, not to be jealous. Those are all in the Torah. And, you know, that's really in the Torah, black and white. You don't even need development of Torah Sheval Peds. It's right there. But the mitzvah between man and God, prayer basically is a rabbinic mitzvah. There may be why some elements of biblical, how we keep Shabbos, 90% of what we do or don't do on Shabbos. Making Kiddush on wine is rabbinic. Kiddush. I just and Sheikh Knesset Hagdola instituted that. All the brachot we make are all rabbinic. So much muksa, so much of the second day of Yontif that we just had yesterday for those who aren't in Israel. So that's all rabbinic. So as now, as you see the Torah, there are really two aspects. As you see the Torah is on the negative side. In other words, make a fence around the Torah, just like you have by the hydro wires, you put a fence to protect people. It means, and Torah says, or the way our sages understood what the Torah says, you can't eat meat enough. The Torah doesn't exactly say that, but that's how the sages interpret the Torah, and that becomes a biblical law, not to eat meat and milk that's cooked together, but that's only meat. To eat chicken and milk that's cooked together is, no prohibition. So the rabbis were afraid people would mix up chopped meat, chopped chicken. They think they're eating chicken and they're eating meat. So the rabbis made a rabbinic law. You can't eat chicken and milk. Rav Yossi Aglili didn't subscribe to that. The Talmud says Rav Yossi Aglili, in his town, he was the rabbi. He thought that was too far-fetched. That was too far. You're not allowed to make a fence 100 feet away. The fence shouldn't be 6 inches away, shouldn't be 100, should be a few feet away. In other words, the fence, you're not allowed, the rabbis say you're not allowed to make a gzeira l'gzeira. You can't make a fence around the fence. In other words, you can't make a law to protect a rabbinic law. You make a rabbinic law to protect a biblical law. So you don't eat chicken and milk because that protects a biblical law. But you can't make a fence around a rabbinic law. So you have to make so that's one type of offense around the Torah. That's what really the Mishnah is referring to protect the Torah. Muksa, so much of what we do is like that. Then there's a second aspect. The Mishnah is not really discussing that as far as I understand it. That's the rabbinic ability to introduce positive aspects. The fact that they introduce Hanukkah and Purim or that we say our brachot, that's not a siyag the Torah. That's the rabbinic authority given to the rabbis, if they have a good reason, to introduce new laws and on a positive sense. But anyways, these are the three sayings that the Mishnah wanted to take from the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, to take your time, have lots of students, make a fence to her. I'll quote what I often quote. I heard when I learned this from Rabbi Meir Berglass, who lives in the Ve'a Lisa, I believe, in Israel, the founder of Mitresh Moriah. For those who live in Toronto may remember, he was the rabbi of Shar Tfila in the 70s. And he taught me my 4 years in high school. He taught me actually Mishnah. We used to learn Mishnah 40 minutes a day. And Rabbi Berglass was our teacher. And I remember he taught us this one very beautiful idea that these three things actually follow on one another. If rabbis are deliberate in judgment, if rabbis take their time with people, they'll have a lot of students. If you're gruff, you know, people don't like you. If you take a question seriously, so you're much more likely to develop the students. And the best protection to Torah, the best fence around the Torah, is lots of Jews who study Torah. When you have a lot of students, that's their best fence through Torah. That's a very nice little sort of homiletic insight into that Mishnah. Okay, maybe we'll just do the next Mishnah on Shimon HaTzadik. Hayami Shairei Anshei Knesset HaGdola. He was from the leftovers or the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. It's a little bit unclear where we don't know too much about the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. We know, let's say, Ezra was part of it. Mordechai was most likely part of it, like, you know, Esther and Mordechai, that Mordechai. Chagai Zechariah Umalachai, the prophets who transitioned. In other words, we said the period a prophecy ends and the period of the sages begin at the Second Temple. But the transitional generation really are Chagai Zechariah and Malachi, or the prophets who bring back help with rebuilding of the Second Temple. And then we transition really to the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. They were members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. The Talmud says, Ubahem Kama Nevi'im. There were 120 people and a few prophets. There was to sort of get it started, and then the question, did it last, how many generations it lasts? Anyway, Shimon HaTzadik is from the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, let's say 3rd century BCE, something like that, 3rd or 4th century BCE. Hoyomer Shloshad Brim Olam HaMed, a famous teaching on three things the world stands. We'll have later on in this chapter, Shloshad Brim Olam Kayam, a lot less famous, but the Mishnah in the end of the first chapter, Rav Shimon Gamliel says there are three things Olam Omeid. He also says Omeid. I think most Mishnah says Kayam. Have a different teaching, but we'll stick with Shimon HaTzadik ala Torah levadal Ogmilut Chasadim. The three pillars of Jewish life are Torah. So the question is, what does that mean? The observance of, presumably means the observance of Torah. Many commentaries understand, of course, on the study of Torah, but it means really Torah is our be-all and end-all. Lim lo briti yomam v'layla chukat shemayim v'aretz lo samti. The rabbis, the pasuk in Yishayahu, that God really created the Torah, the world, for the purpose of the Torah. He stuck up our raita ubar alma. He looked and the Torah created the world. Like when an architect builds a house, or you build a house, you have the architectural plans. The plans are there first, and then the building comes. So God's plan for the world was based on the Torah. It's actually a very powerful teaching in many other ways. Basically, what it means is sometimes it is hard, but the Torah is part of the natural world. It's not something, when we say, Moshe Rabbeinu says, it's not me'aver liyam, it's not b'shamayim, it's not, it's karove lecha, it's close to you. It's part of our being. It's part of God looked at the Torah when he built the world, meaning the world can exist with the Torah happening. We're going to have, actually coming up, if I can put in a half a plug, one of the series we're going to have now online is Rav Avia Tabori is going to give a series on halakhic issues with the founding of the State of Israel. How do you run a state? How do you run an electric grid? You can't close it down on Shabbos. You can't close down every factory. You just can't in manufacturing sometimes. So how do you do that? But there has to be a way to do it. We think there has to be a way, because God created the world that the Torah can work in that world. So we have to work hard to figure out how we can apply Shabbos in the modern world. Okay, is electricity allowed? Isn't that? That's you can come to that. That's going to be on Thursday mornings at 11 a.m. And we can see on the email. Anyway, Al HaTorah. Now Al Avodah. So what is Torah? What's what does Avodah mean? I've been talking the whole time. I'll let somebody else answer. I don't know if what does Avodah mean? Everybody's afraid to say anything. Okay. Avoda is worship. So what does it mean? So the classical understanding of Avoda tended to be Avodat HaKorbanot, right? And their psukim in that, the bringing Korbanot. Now, that in itself, of course, depends who you are. According to the Rambam, he wasn't such a big fan of the Korbanot, at least not philosophically, right? But Avoda means whether Korbanot, for sure, but of course the Mishnah is written after the destruction of the temple. So there were no korbanot. So it's a little bit strange to say that the world stands on three pillars when one of the pillars is missing. Whatever your view on korbanot, it's a little bit strange that the Mishnah would list it 150 years after the temple is destroyed. So avoda means probably prayer. Ezahi avoda shebelev. What's prayer is known as avoda shebelev. The Rambam, unique among all medieval authorities. The Rambam is the only authority who believe, as far as I know, the only major authority who believes that prayer is a biblical obligation. I've mentioned this in many contexts, but it's worth repeating. It's a beautiful idea. You know, there's a famous dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam claims there's a biblical mitzvah to pray. Of course, that doesn't mean three times a day. That means once a day. There's a biblical mitzvah to pray once a day, and it doesn't mean everything we say. It means you have to, basically Shmone Esrei, but it didn't even mean the whole Shmone Esrei. I mean, you have to give praise to God and ask God for something on Thanksgiving. In 2 minutes, once a day, you fulfill your biblical obligation. There's a rabbinic obligation to pray three times a day, et cetera, et cetera. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says there's no biblical obligation to pray at all. Well, he has one exception, but there's basically no biblical obligation to pray. But prayer, and this is what I find so beautiful, if we could follow this, it's very hard. Prayer is an act of chesed of God. God is very kind to us. He allows us to pray. When we can pray, what a chutzpah that we go to God and ask him for wealth and for health and for wisdom. What are we, nuts? If you want to get a meeting with the prime minister, you can't get a meeting. God is so kind to us. He allows us to daven. Prayer is a great act of kindness of God. That's how the Ramban explains it. Prayer is a very difficult mitzvah. I don't have to tell everybody knows it's very hard. But if we could internalize that Ramban, that would be a very beautiful idea. That where it's not an obligation. I wish I didn't have to pray, but you know I have to go to shul. What can I do? Or have to daven at home. Whatever. It's that's often our attitude. But if we keep the Ramban in mind, it's not. Prayer's not an obligation. Prayer's a gift that we have an opportunity to connect to God. But the Ramban says the only time that prayer is an obligation is the Eitz Hara. If you look in the Torah and Parshat Balotcha, the Torah says in a time of war, utkatem b'chatzotrot, you have to blow the shofar, the chatzotrot. And we know the shofar is a form of prayer. It's prayer without words. We say words. Words are limiting. We don't know how to fully express ourselves. So we make words, and then we blow sounds, that God should turn the sounds into what our prayers. That's why we blow shofar in the middle of the Shmone Esrei. So it says in the Torah, you sound the trumpets in a time of war. So that Ramban derives from there, that in a time of great need, in a time of, then there's an obligation to cry out to God. And Rav Soloveitchik has his very famous comment that there is no debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. They really are not arguing. Everybody agrees prayer emanates from a sense of need, the obligation to pray. Just the Rambam says man is in a perpetual state of need. He may not know it, but every day man has needs. He has to pray every day. And the Ramban says only when you know it, you have needs. But fundamentally, I sort of like the first half of Avodah being sort of not so much an obligation, but an act of kindness. So Avodah probably in the Mishnah, I would assume, is more prayer than Korbanot. And if I want to give a modern interpretation, not a modern interpretation, but an important idea, Avodah can mean like Avodah, work, Torah of Avodah. Like I grew up in Bnei Akiva, you know, the slogan of Bnei Akiva, Torah, work on a kibbutz, Avodah, work the land, which we know it's a great mitzvah in the Torah. I mean, so much of the Torah is working the land. When God put man in Gan Eden, He told him to to work the garden and to guard the garden. So avodah is a very important aspect to work for a living. The Gemara in bracket says yagia kapecha. When we make when the labor, the sweat of our hands, or however you translate it, the sweat of our brow from our work, we sustain ourselves, ashrecha b'tovlek. We're blessed in this world and the next world. That's greater than those who study Torah. That's what the Gemara says, because to be able to support yourself. So aboda, work, and that's how the world develops. That's the simple way. That's the second pillar. So we have korbanot, prayer, work, the second pillar of the Torah. And of course, the third one, gemilut chasadim, acts of kindness between people, between humans, being nice to people. And I was just reading an interesting article, but whenever we make on the mitzvah between man and man, we don't make a bracha. You know, I said the Anshei Knesset HaGdola established we have to make our brachot, and, you know, rabbinic literature teaches you're supposed to make at least 100 blessings a day. It's not hard. The Devon Shemone Esrei three times a day is up to 57. Birchat HaShachar is another 15, you're up to 72. It's very easy. But yeah, you have to say 100 brachot a day. But there are no brachot that I can think of between man and man. This is discussed usually in the context of on the mitzvah, on staka. There's no blessing. And the simple reason is because we should not do a mitzvah between man and man because it's a mitzvah. I mean, yes, it is a mitzvah, but we do it because it's the right thing to do. I don't give staka because I can do a mitzvah. And to make a bracha when I give somebody charity is almost like, it's how could you do such a thing? You're turning the person into an object, that you're the object of my mitzvah. I give staka because I have to. That's the beautiful comment the Maharal of Prague has. It says in the Torah, by the mitzvah of staka. The mitzvah of staka is written twice in the Torah. Once in Re'eh, that's the more famous place. Patok titachet yatka, open your hand, don't clench your fist or open your heart. That's the more famous place in Re'eh in the context of Shemitah, Maser Sheni, the gifts to the poor. But it's also in Mishpatim, and there it's not so much quote unquote charity, but a loan, which we know is a higher form of charity. Im kesef talbet ami, if you lend your friend money, don't charge interest. It's said in the context not to charge interest. Anyway, so im kesef talbet ami, if you lend your friend money, your person money, these are the laws. So Rashi has a comment there. This is one of three times in the Torah where the word im, if, doesn't mean if. It means when. There's an obligation when you lend money. The Torah uses the word if, but it's not really if. It means you're obligated if you can afford it. If you can afford it and your friend needs a loan, you're obligated to lend. And no interest. We won't get into the risk of later development business loan. That's beyond this. So you have to lend them. So the Maharal of Prague asks a very simple question. If the Torah meant to say when, why doesn't it say when? Why does it say if? I mean, what do you mean? Rashi, one of the three times the Torah says if, and it means when. So say what you mean. Well, why does the Torah have to write what it doesn't mean? So the Maharal of Prague beautifully explains that the Torah wants us to give charity as a volunteer. We shouldn't give charity because we're obligated to give charity. We should give charity because we care about other people. We want to help people. So mitzvot, so the Torah writes it. Don't give it as an obligation. I mean, people do give it. It's better to give it an obligation than not to give it all. But you should give it because it's milut chasadim. We care about other people. So there's a sharp break. When you do mitzvot between man and God, you're doing it because God commanded. So as the Rambam writes, a Jew should say, I would love to eat pork. Pork is great. What's wrong with eating pork? God told us I can't, so I won't. But there's nothing wrong. There's nothing immoral about eating pork. Only because God said so. Mitzvot between man and God because God said so. There may be a good reason for it, but the obligation stems from God. Mitzvot between man and man. Yes, it also stems from God. God, of course, also commands us this, but it has to come because we want to do it, because of the chesed that we want to do it. I've often pointed out, we'll end with this, that Gemilu Chasadin, a gamal, right? Gemilu Chasadin comes word of a gamal, a camel, because a camel is the sign of chesed, because the camel doesn't need any provisions. When it takes you in the desert, right? That was the animal that used to transfer it in the desert. It doesn't need its own food. It regurgitates its own food. So the gamal became the symbol. Gemilut chasadim is tied to a gamal. But anyways, these are the three things that Rav Shimon, Shimon Hatzadi says, the three pillars of the world. So I'll just give maybe a 1 minute review of what we did. We discussed the minhag to learn Pirkei Avot in the summer. We added the sixth chapter before Shavuot, talks about the importance of Torah, the placement of Pirkei Avot in the Zikin, in the part of the Mishnah that deals relationships between man and man. That's where we need it most. We mentioned there are many experts in Agadat literature. Pirkei Avot is obviously different than the other tractates of the Talmud, and there are 22 people, I believe, if I counted correctly, who are mentioned only in Pirkei Avot and nowhere else in the entire Talmud, which I find quite fascinating. We said the first two chapters really have two lines. One, the historical line from Moshe Rabbeinu through Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi to his son, how the Nisi'im, the leaders of the people. And then we break off from Hillel, and we do his students, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who were really the great Torah leaders of the generation. Those are the first two chapters on Pirkei Avot. And we mentioned, obviously, we don't have to say Moshe, Yoshua's gaining, because that's, you look in Tanakh, and you know what they said. We begin with the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, which is the beginning of the period of the Torah Shebaal Peh. There was a fundamental shift in the nature of Torah from a fixed written like text. We were told what to do by prophets, by the high priest. We didn't have to really figure out. And that all changes in the Second Temple period, where we developed the Torah. And many of the Torah laws weren't, it's not because they're written in the Torah. It's how the rabbis can, 1,000 years later, can sit and understand the Torah. And that becomes a biblical law. They're understanding the Torah. And you can have Moshe Rabbeinu making a rabbinic law. We said what the Anshei Knesset Hagdola were the ones who set in the patterns of ritual religious life that we observe to this day, Shmon Esrei, Kiddush, Havdalah, Brachot, etc. And we discussed a little bit what they said, taking your time, having lots of students to debate Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and that our students put a fence around the Torah. And then we discussed Shimon HaTzadik, the three, our tripod of Jewish existence, learning Torah, observing Torah, Avodah, prayer, Korbanot, work, and so I want to wish everybody wonderful, wonderful Shabbat. Everybody should be healthy. We should hear good news. And please God, we'll have a number of classes next week, and some will start the week after. I'll send by email everything that we have going. And I want to wish everybody a great day. Thank you very much. Any questions? I'm happy to answer any questions. Okay. Have a good one, everybody. Thank you.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Still taking questions?
Sure. If you ask, I'm happy to answer your question.
You're talking about fences around the Torah.
Yeah.
So I know the Torah says, you know, somewhere, I forget where it is, that you shouldn't add or subtract from the Torah.
Yeah.
So, but fences, it's understandable. Rashi talks about it there. So you can protect the laws of the Torah. Mm-hmm. On what basis do they introduce new laws?
Good. So the Gemara, correct. It's a great question. The Gemara asked that question on Hanukkah. The Gemara says when you light Hanukkah candles, you have to make three brachot. Asher kishanu mitzvah b'tzivanu ladik ner shel Hanukkah. The Gemara says, v'heikan tzivanu, where did God command this? It's not true. God didn't command this. So the Gemara has two answers to that question. Lo tasur, that the Torah says you have to listen to what the rabbis say. Now, the rabbis have to have a good reason, but the Torah gave the rabbis permission. Otherwise, Torah would be a dead book. In order to make Torah relevant, the rabbis need the authority to introduce new laws and new ordinances and new holidays. Yom HaTzmaut. Say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut, right? That, I think most people I see here, I assume we all celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, right?
What does Lot HaTur mean?
I'm sorry?
Where does that Lot HaTur refer?
You're right. So how does Lot do not fear from what the rabbis say? In other words, you have to listen to the rabbis. That's the Torah's permission. But the Rambam writes, they have to make it clear. It's a rabbinic law. They can't make up the Torah's. The way the Rambam explains, if the rabbis were to say meat, a chicken and milk was a Torah prohibition, that would be a violation of the Torah. That's adding to the Torah. But if the rabbis say we're going to make a rabbinic fence, and they admit it's a rabbinic law, but even in the Kiddush of the Torah, the inside of the Torah, is even on positive mitzvot. And the second verse they quote is Shalavicha v'yagetcha zekeinecha v'yomru lach. Ask your parents and they will tell you, ask the elders. And there's an idea that the leaders of every generation have to introduce new laws or whatever, you know, if they can. You're I mean, it's a very broad topic and there's a lot to discuss in rabbinic authority, but basically they're not allowed, they have to watch a fine line. And that's why there are rules. They can't make a rabbinic fence to protect the rabbinic law. That's too much. That's adding too much. They have to go and whatever. And, you know, but we know throughout so much, you know, Hillel made a Prus Bowl and so many new things were instituted. But Hanukkah and Purim are the best examples of on a positive law. And then you have all the negative laws that the rabbis introduced. I hope that helps a little.
A little.
Okay. Well, we can have one day we'll have a series, please God, on rabbinic authority. There's a lot to discuss there. It's an important subject, one not studied too much, I think, by most people. All right.
Unfortunately, some of these fences they make end up splitting the people apart, like kidneys.
Right. So kidney is not a fence. Kidney is a minhag. That's right. So you have no way.
Kidney is a fence to protect us. And not actually, they say not to actually make chometz.
Right. The people, the minhag of kidneyot started probably, I don't know if it started from the people of the rabbis, right? It is a minhag. It shouldn't split us. Right. See, until this generation, there was no problem, or two generations ago, because a Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jew, they never met each other. Right. If you lived in the Middle Ages in Spain, and you lived in Germany, the Balei HaTosar are living in France, and the Ravid and the Rambam are living in Spain. They never saw each other. The Tosfot never once quotes the Rambam. It's actually an amazing, as far as I know, in the entire commentary of Tosfot and Talmud, never does he quote the Rambam. And the Rambam died in 1204. Tosfot, the era of the Tosfot, goes till the end of the 13th century. They never quote the Rambam. They knew of the Rambam, believe me, in time and Tosfot, but it was a different world, the Ashkenazic world. So they had a minhag here and a minhag there, no big deal. Today, you come to Israel, so fine. So, right. So, certain, there are questions. What do you do? You marry a Sephardi girl? I don't know what I think. I'm just not sure. But, you know, like if kidneyot is going to stop, I think in certain circles, you know, people are eating kidneyot on the fringes. And, we'll see what happens. But you're right. It should not create a machloket. Sometimes it does, unfortunately. But that's a minhag. That was instituted post-Talmudic. You're right. You have to be very careful not to institute. Whenever you institute.
When's the next Zoom lecture?
Next Zoom lecture will probably be on Monday, but I'll send out emails about it. A lot of the people who are going to teach want to wait a week to get prepared, which, you know, is understandable, of course. But Mark Shapiro will be speaking 8:30 on Monday night. And I'm going to work on it. It's only 10:30 now, and I have a few hours to work on it the rest of the day.
I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay.
Give me a chance.
People coming. Otherwise, you know, that's what's what it's all about. Okay, listen, we have to make the best of the situation, and it's wonderful, all the tour around the world. How many people? Like, how many Zoom shares? It's really an amazing thing. All right. Have a good one, everybody. Thank you very much.